You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
What do you think of when you hear the word sex trafficking? Maybe your mind goes back to this moment in 2012 in Uganda.
He's a warlord who experts say is responsible for the kidnapping of up to 70,000 people, many of them children. Operating first in Uganda, now in three other African countries, he and his militants have killed and disfigured tens of thousands of villagers, forced young boys to become child soldiers, forced girls into sexual slavery. Joseph Kony and his so-called Lord's Resistance Army have been doing this for a quarter century.
Or maybe the image is the sound of freedom for you now. The movie starring Jim Caviezel portraying Tim Ballard, a former U.S. government agent who embarks on a mission to rescue children from sex traffickers in Colombia with daring rescues.
Now, Timoteo, the kid, Miguel, back with his father, huh?
Yes.
How'd that make you feel? Giving a child his freedom.
Felt good.
Like back rub good or chicken wings good. What kind of good are we talking about here?
The kind that gives hope.
Come on, amigo. You have been at this for 12 years. Why are you doing it?
Because God's children are not for sale.
Now the words sex trafficking are being associated with another elite celebrity besides Jeffrey Epstein.
Video of Sean Diddy Combs on Star Island amidst a sex trafficking investigation. Meantime, new details on the most recent lawsuit against him. His former music producer, Rodney Jones, says he was forced to solicit sex workers from the Booby Trap strip club. Jones is asking for $30 million in damages after accusing Diddy of sex trafficking, abuse, forced drug use, and sexual assault. Diddy has denied all of those allegations.
Now, all of these accounts of the suffering of women and men undergoing commercial sexual exploitation dominate our media and mental images, but they're not the norm. The reality is that what was once called sex trafficking is happening in our own neighborhoods. And my guest today, Mark Steenbarger, is a filmmaker who works to liberate those trapped in a cycle of abuse. He shares with us the typical face of commercial sexual exploitation, what is being done to fight it, and how we can be vigilant with our own kids. Stay tuned for that conversation here on The Chris Spangle Show. Tell us what you do. Tell us about Point of View Story.
Yeah. So I started Point of View Story around circa 2018, got more active in 2019. And we're trying to help those coming out of sex trafficking in the healing-centered agencies that walk alongside those with that lived experience and find healing. And what we have found, and which is good because this is the thing I'm good at, is creating moments. And so utilizing film, like actual movies, as a intervention tool or as a prompt to a conversation, mm-hmm. somebody's able to reflect and engage with the film, put themselves in that story, and processing that after the film with a trained facilitator, they can get unstuck on their healing journey. So our films are narrative. So that means they're fictional. They're stories that my crew and I write and create with our community of lived experience folks and clinical folks. And I work directly with an impact producer. Her name's Emily Taylor Ginger. She has over 10 years of counseling, of therapy with those, we call it. So to the term, use the term commercial sexual exploitation. And you mentioned under 18, and unfortunately, children are very much part of this. So if you add children, the acronym can be CSEC, C-S-E-C, or CSE for commercial sexual exploitation. And so Emily has 10 plus years of working with those coming through that. And when my wife, who was working at the same agency back in 2019, that's when I learned that, oh my gosh, it's not this thing in Africa where they grab them into a white van and move them to another location.
And it may be, right?
And it may be. Yeah, actually, right. It is, right. But for here in Indianapolis and most of the United States, it is, in my opinion, it's worse. Mm. And so my wife was a case manager working with Emily, and that's how we got connected. And that's when I learned, oh my goodness, can we create a moment for these young people to find healing? And Emily had her own story where she had a client who, when you go through experience like that, you develop new beliefs that can get in your own way. And so one of that is very shame-based. And So if I said, Chris, you're worthy of having a podcast, I think you could be really good at it. your shame could be so large, you'll say, Mark, no, I can never do that. And so now we're in a verbal loop, right? Like mm-hmm. I can say that to you all day long, but if I can show you a film where you just watch the journey of somebody starting a podcast or key inciting incidents in a 5-minute dense film and ask you, what do you think he's feeling or she's feeling? And then you begin to process that and why not you, Chris? That just really pivots the belief. And that's
how did you develop that technique? Because that to me seems very smart. It's hard for people to open up and admit,
yes,
look, that's not me. There's almost a defense mechanism with any kind of trauma for folks of, yeah, that's other people maybe, but that's not happening to me.
That's not happening to me. And what did happen to me only happened to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Both I think are true.
So it's very disarming the way that you've set this up. How did you arrive at that idea?
I grew up in the church background where, regardless of someone's faith, if you look at Jesus from a storyteller's perspective, he used this structure called parables. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by that because they were short and they got people thinking.
Yeah.
And putting themselves in those stories. So I'm like, I'm just going to take that as a story structure. Instead of a three-act play, let's do a parabolic, if that's a word, approach to this. And then also, if you Google cinema therapy, you will find tons of research and evidence of how this has been studied. And so just leaning into that and also creating metaphors and abilities for folks to connect with an idea or a subtextual moment, I felt like, yeah, this should work. And I knew from my own experience watching Days of Thunder, if that tells you how, worth laughing. Yeah, go ahead. Right. It's
when I think of how I create trafficking videos, it always starts with Days of Thunder.
Did you see it, Mike?
Of course. Yeah, I was a huge race fan. I still am. Yeah.
Tom Cruise, right? And there's that moment after his wreck and it's back, the journey back to getting back in the car or whatever. And there's that deja vu moment where that smoke screen's there. And what does he do? And that scene for me really stuck because we hit moments of life and all I see is smoke. And I just fear history will now repeat itself. But who's in my headset? Who's talking to me? Mm. Say, go hi. And why am I choking up right now about Days of Thunder? but like that just stuck with me, that image. And I literally took that frame and I printed it off and it's on my wall at home, like just to point back to it. So I was like, that moved the needle a little bit for me. Mm-hmm. How many times do we watch a documentary and get new insights and we're moved? A buddy of mine once said, you don't care what I have to say, but if I put to a song, you'll listen. And so I felt, this might have efficacy. And then I did sit down with a psychologist that does this work and Emily herself. The rest of her story was she showed her client who was stuck in that verbal loop I was alluding to earlier. So she showed her very young girls. It's a documentary Showtime did out of an agency that we would partner with called GEMS. And they documented 4 or 5 girls and their experience. And watching that, she immediately was like, that is me. Mm. And so both of those...
Someone coming from the outside saying, look, this is a problem. And they see that and then they identify with it. So it almost is like a light bulb turning on for them.
It really is. Epiphany moments. Yeah.
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 Did you have a background as a filmmaker?
So I have a background as a performing arts guy. So I went to college at Taylor University for computer science, did that for 29 years. But underneath that all, I was doing community theater. I was doing comedy sports and downtown Indy, on Mass Ave, doing stand-up. And then I started my own comedy troupe and we're traveling. I was making moments, as my wife put it. Mm-hmm. And when I learned what trafficking really is, I was like, oh my goodness, can they have a moment? Can we create a moment for them where they can just get those aha moments? We got stickers now that ask, what's your moment? Mm. And we're trying to create these aha moments, these epiphanies, these discoveries of the beliefs that they're holding. So that they can, now that they can identify it and they can see it, now we can process it. Now we can work with it.
What does trafficking look like in a city like Indianapolis, 12th largest city, Midwestern city?
Yes.
Very, I don't know. If somebody outside of the country thought of America, they'd probably think of Indianapolis and the people in it, right? And it's not a dangerous city. It's not falling apart. It's actually a pretty great place to live, right? Trying to paint the picture for those of you who have been in Indiana, I think it's just boring and a little conservative. And it's not like the visions of San Francisco where everything is on fire, even though it's a very beautiful city and perfectly fine.
Yes.
What does that look like here in Indianapolis?
Yeah. I would say it also, these models, if you will, for lack of a better term, are pretty consistent nationwide.
In terms of the patterns of what happens.
Yeah, the patterns of what's happened.
For women and men.
Yeah, and boys. And girls. And LGBTQ communities. Yeah, it's a term, pimp controlled. Let's start with that language. It's this notion of typically a male will befriend a younger woman. So think 22-something befriending a 14-year-old.
Okay.
And he's able, and he's looking for vulnerabilities, but not, what's a little unfortunate is when you Google vulnerabilities, you'll see things like shelter, food access, things of that nature, which are true. Mm-hmm. But the vulnerabilities we're really zooming in on are things like self-esteem, identity, who do you trust, and things like a lot of our technology with Snapchat, things like that. Stranger danger is really harder to bring in.
I was listening to Jonathan Haidt on Joe Rogan's podcast talk about his new book, and he's saying the instances of kids being abused or stolen out in the world are like way lower and doesn't exist anymore because they're all on Snapchat. They're all on Instagram. That's where your kids are being accessed by people who are predatory.
Oh my gosh. If I wanted, when growing up, if I wanted to go on a date, I had to go to a front door, knock on the door, hope the dad liked me.
Yeah.
And very palm sweating experience. Now, yeah, these kids are in their bedroom, in the privacy of their bedrooms, and they're chatting with people they've never met. And so this 20-something-year-old, and they may, it could just be scouring profiles or whatever, but if they're on Instagram, things like that, they are able to, how girls present, how they present themselves, be able to identify these vulnerabilities. If it's in the space, like in real life, seeing them coming from schools or seeing them at a mall, this sobering story where it was explained to me, like three girls could be walking down in the mall, and out of the three, he could tell which one was confident, which one had the vulnerabilities, and which one he would approach.
Has anybody identified like how those guys tell? Like what is the...
Yeah, I think it's body posture. I think it's, just where like who's the one that's talking, who's the one that's following. Mm. And then they just laser in on them. And so how do they get access, whether it's through friends or saying I'm a friend of...
So it's not like... Maybe it is, but maybe you could do percentages. Like it's literally they're out in the world, they see a kid, and then they somehow get access to them on social media.
Totally.
As opposed to just on social media and randomly.
I think both are happening.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
There used to be a website that fortunately they took down where it was like, that's getting ahead of myself. That's how you could, guys were purchasing. But how they're actually connecting with these girls is both ways. Like in real life, identifying them, befriending the befriends. So a girl that's in the life, I will also befriend another peer and say, hey, I want you to go to this party with me. We got these friends, these guys.
That kind of rings true to the Epstein thing. It was like you couldn't have Jeffrey Epstein without Ghislaine Maxwell. She was almost the person who came in and said, oh, this is okay. Yes. It's not a weird, creepy guy. There's another woman here.
Right. Normalization is a huge part of this whole. And how do they get access? They begin to just fill that void, that vulnerability. So it's love bombing, right? It's, I love you, you're beautiful. I bet your parents, and they know what to fish for. Like, how are your parents? Do your parents, and just start to get them talking about all the things. Like, so yeah, my parents, my mom's boyfriend lives with us now, and I can't stand him. I'm so sorry. I understand you. I get that. I had that too. I totally know what you're going through. So all these empathetic moves that build connection and attachment. And so that's what they call grooming. So these grooming tactics will be applied, and either online through chats or in person, they'll date them. If you read Google Rebecca Bender, you read her story and her book, this guy dated her and was with her for months and then said, hey, I got to go to Vegas to do this music job. It's no place for a family, so you need to stay here. And all she heard was, you see us as a family. I'm in.
Mm.
And so then that next piece, after whether it's a matter of weeks, or it's usually weeks or months, although I met somebody in Canada, and this was her. Fortunately, she did not get trafficked, but how she got approached was an old man in a wheelchair rolled up to her and said, hey, can I borrow your phone? So like maybe homeless presenting. And she's like, yeah, I'm a nice person. Yeah, you can borrow my phone, text whoever you call, whoever you need to, so they can come get you, that kind of thing. No more as she had got her phone back within seconds. Her phone's blowing up with, hey, beautiful, come over here. And then threats follow immediately. So I haven't heard that scenario as much. It's usually this long game that I've been hearing. And so that's...
But the key is it's not kidnapped off the street.
Absolutely not. No.
It's not even necessarily the story of the homeless presenting guy saying, do this or else. It's someone who is already vulnerable, being seduced over a long period of time.
Seduced over a long period of time. And, great way of saying it.
Yeah. And as having a five-year-old girl and a nine-month-old boy, the best way to avoid that as a parent is to just instill in my kids what?
These vulnerabilities. And our films are centered around these vulnerabilities. And the buzzword we use is increase the protective factors. Because, again, back to those three girls, the one that's confident, the one that knows who she is and her identity, and they won't touch her. They know their approaches will be futile. So they leave her alone and she's protected. Yeah. And so the best thing you can do is speak into your kids the value that they're loved unconditionally. I was in a meeting yesterday and a guy says he was pitching I am statements just as a good mental practice. And he goes, every night after I read my kids' stories, I go through I am statements. I go, who's beautiful? And she goes, I'm beautiful. I don't know how many he goes through, but like those practices I think are powerful.
To the days of thunder, I don't want to make you weep again, but to the days of thunder, who's in your headset?
Right.
What is that Absolutely. Mental? Yes. For me, and I've talked about this on the show, but going through therapy for 4 years, twice a week for two, I had a lot to work out, but... It was all fixing that mental tape.
Yeah.
And even now, every day, there's something that happens. I'm sitting here going, today, I'm like, this person doesn't like me.
Right.
And then I have to sit there and go, are they having a bad day?
Yes.
It's not about you. It's yes. It's like retraining that mental tape to go through. And so with our kids, we're trying to do that. We're trying to, my wife is much more secure, confident. But we're trying to instill that in our kids to protect them. Good mental hygiene, I guess, right?
Yeah, totally.
Almost the idea of, as Christians, it's Good Friday, right? When we're recording this, the catechism. Why do we have a catechism? It's you are constantly repeating the same things over and over because you're catechizing. And if your kids are on social media catechizing themselves with messages of depression, of anxiety, of whatever those messages are, they're catechized into a certain way of thinking, and that can have real-world consequences, what I'm hearing you
Absolutely.
Say.
Those are the vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And they could start with the teardown and gaslighting their parents, gaslighting their friends. So isolation is also a big piece of that. So when they finally meet in real life, the isolation begins, where they will remove her either literally from everybody or at least remove them from their connections, right? Take their phones or... what have you, so that they become her world. That guy becomes
It sounds so much like the episodes on domestic violence that we've done.
Yeah.
It's the same pattern.
Yeah, it really is. It's just a deeper, darker route. Because at the end of the day, he has no true love feelings. He really is there just to monetize this whole exchange. And he's not going to do this to one girl. He's going to do it and repeat the process. And then pit the girls against each other and make them competitive. To a point where the one that gets to stay with the pimp is called the bottom girl, and has higher status in this jacked up. And so he pits that against them and then uses reward systems and holds their money for them. But
financial dependency.
Yeah, creates that dependency, introduces drugs to help them just get through the day. Because these sexual assaults are easily 10 times a day. We're talking 7 days a week. So that's 70 times a week. And in some cases, some of these girls have been in these lives for decades. The numbers are just hard to get your head around. But somebody in her 30s could have had over 24,000 sexual assaults in her lifetime.
So is it prostitution? Is sex trafficking the same as prostitution? It sounds like it, but I think in layman's terms, you're existing in a world of different terms and different shades of gray than maybe like black or white thinking like some of us might have. But is it these guys going after women to gather a group of women that they are then selling to, probably men, but also women, right? And there's also men being trafficked. And is that the bottom line? It's just like a pipeline to prostitution?
Yeah, it's selling sex for sure. Okay. And yes, the idea of selling, so the buyer, sadly, is typically a 50-something-year-old white guy, is the prominent buyer. And so he is collecting and selling these girls. And the Sound of Freedom did get this part right. They said a drug you can only sell once, but a body you can sell and resell. And so it is totally just a money thing. And back to the language of commercial sexual exploitation, it is a commercial move. It's a transaction to get money for sex. Again, but we're still just talking about the pimp-controlled paradigm. There's also familial trafficking where a mom will pimp out their kids for...
Yeah, I saw in one of the videos a mom pimping out her son.
For decades.
And that blew my mind.
Yeah, and that is less of one guy just trying to profiteer from the prostitution, as you said, but it's really a survival skill that's gone left, and the mom is just utilizing that as a token, as a way to survive, and a way to move through the world. And
to financially survive?
To financially survive.
Okay.
Yeah, but rather than pressing into good services, they're actually doing this, and odds are she went through a similar experience. And again, that normalization takes place. You and I sit here like, how could you ever sell your kid? We can't get our head around that.
But my mom did it to me and I'm okay. Look.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
It gets so normalized.
Yeah.
And the gentleman you're referring to, he said he was out 30 years till he realized he had been trafficked, because it is so normalized. And therapists will tell you 70% that come to their door don't know they're being trafficked. And that's why I think the word traffic is a little bit of a misnomer, because they're not going anywhere. They're here. Yeah. They're in this just horrible DV on steroids type relationship.
Yeah, that was my next question. I have a friend who works at strip clubs, and she says all the time people will come in.
Yeah.
That most of the girls, especially the girls who work there who are veterans, I guess we'd say, have been in the industry for a long time. Look out for the younger girls because they're too stupid to see what's happening.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Totally. And so that was like my first time I went, oh, this is happening around here. And I could just be going into Starbucks or Target. And it's not like I think Netflix documentaries do a disservice to so many different of these issues, because we think of the extreme of the kid is in the basement, locked in the basement with three other kids, right? That's not what it is. No. It's a kid at school, going to school.
Still going to school sometimes.
Or the man or woman at Starbucks that you're sitting next to, both working on your laptop. Somebody in your office that isn't caged, isn't chained to anything.
Right.
They're psychologically chained.
But and that's how I try to differentiate. This isn't taken by physical force. This is taken by mental force. And unfortunately, Google images and you pop in sex trafficking, you usually get duct tape. Tape over the mouth, tape over the hands. Right. Yeah, and it's so far from that. Some of these girls are still going home at the end of the day, and the parents are clueless to what's happening.
Wow.
So it's that in plain sight, as it were.
So what is it like going... Give me an average example. Is it somebody just is going to work? She'd be going to work at Dairy Queen and then coming home? Is it like a physical location where this is happening? Is it...
Yeah, it's not... Yeah, it's... Not one size fits all by any means. So if it's somebody under 18, they could be going to school and then telling their parents, I'm going to soccer practice. For somebody else, if they're actually in living with him, it's probably all day. And then in evenings, those like back to Bender's story when she was in Vegas, like it's working the casinos. And so you work all night long and you sleep during the morning or part of the day, but very little sleep. And you're just, told to work and work. And then reward system. So if you don't come home with the right amount of money, there's consequences. There's one gal, her story was the buyer didn't have enough money. Like they had it was agreed upon, $500, whatever it was, and he was short. So she came back short and he beat her, like pistol whipped her. And she said, he had more, but you told me not to take change. He goes, no, take change. So the next time he let the guy include change behind dollar bills, came back. He goes, I told you, we don't take change, and then beat her with a pillow with the change. So just that constant mind games, even in that, no matter what you do, it's wrong. And so like just beating them down to a point. One gal, she, back to the way it was normalized, she was dating this guy. Again, this long game, this dating, grooming approach. And the way he brought it into her, said, hey, my mom's got this small business. And so using mom, oh, we're talking about a coffee shop, a bakery, and small business. Like just using that language normalized it. And then as he explained it to her, she goes, whoa, wait a minute. It sounds like prostitution. I ain't a hoe. And then he flipped it on her and said, all my girls, they've got nice clothes, purses. They're not on assistance, food stamps, SNAP. But you are. And so who's the hoe now? And that got her in. That was, to her, was evidence your way is right. And after all, it's your mom. So she went in. And then after months of being in there, she's the one out. And he goes, oh, nobody wants you, bitch. You're a hoe.
Yeah. How are you going to go out in the real world? And yeah.
Yeah. And so he flipped on her. So now she was stuck because that mental captivity got her stuck. And so she stayed for more years out. And eventually, thank God she got out. But like that, they are literally stuck there. That's just how strong the mental grip is on these girls and boys.
Yeah. The, I'm 40. And the rise of pornography, porn was always there. When I was in high school, a friend would get a tape, right?
Magazine.
It was very rare, right? And then somewhere in late college, all of a sudden with the cell phone explosion, it's everywhere. And it's just, it would be hard to explain to somebody who is 20 the order of magnitude more that there is in the world. And I never heard anybody culturally or personally ever preach against that, talk about that. Maybe I saw like the group, I think there's a group, XXX, that was like a Christian group maybe. Yeah. But there was never anybody in my life until the last few years that was like, this is wrong for these reasons and push back on it. And then you dive into it and you realize how much of pornography is women stuck in these cycles.
It really is. Oh my gosh.
Can you give... Because if you watch it, it's, oh, they're just starting OnlyFans and they're happy about it and they're doing this and that. But what's the order of magnitude? What's the percentage, or are there figures or an understanding of how much of the pornography that you are, not you, but the royal you, we are consuming in the world is actually women stuck in the cycle?
Yeah, and I don't have specific numbers, but I can guarantee it's large, vast majority. So I have a personal friend who came from that industry, and it's a similar grooming approaches, right? She was told, here's what our offer is. You will never be asked to do anything you're uncomfortable with. Here's your person. If you're ever uncomfortable, you just call her. Like, they gave her all the right things. But when it came to those moments, they flipped on her. They said, you're being ridiculous. You're being too whatever. Everybody... Again, the normalization. Like,
everybody does this.
Yeah. Are you really squawking about that? Come on. And just, again, that pressure. And so she stayed in it. She goes, but it was 100% that life. And they controlled her. And they controlled the money. It was the pimp story, but just in that context. And so the number of women that say, hey, I'm just freely choosing this path. And I'm going to be treated like an actress if I was in a normal movie. I don't know of anybody that has that true story. I believe it. It probably does exist, but it's such the minority. I'm putting in the 1-2% would be my best educated guess. That well over 90% of the time, this is not a good, healthy job with benefits. It is a very harm.
Yeah, because this experience. Sex, being a libertarian especially, you see sex work is dignified work and it's important and this is women's empowerment. And what I'm hearing you say is you're opening a door to places that you may not have control. You may be making the choice to be liberated and empowered, but that may not be the end result.
And that's just the way it's running. There could be a utopian setup where that can take place, but the reality of how it's being played out. And strip clubs is not much that much better. So there's two agencies here in Indy that work with girls that are actively in the strip clubs and just offering them a way out if they want it. Because a lot of them, it's behind the curtain, as it were. It's still a pimp-controlled dynamic. Mm.
So a way out meaning what? Other jobs? Housing? Yeah. What? What does that look like?
Yeah, they're out? Those are trying to provide those on-ramps out. So it is, and those are, now you're starting to talk about the agencies we're reaching out to, where depending on what the agency is, it could be a mentoring type thing where, hey, I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to help you find new jobs. I'm going to help you figure out housing. And they've brokered deals. In fact, there was an email came through yesterday. I forget what they're dubbing it. But the idea is when you're in this life, a lot of times financial things happen to you. So bad credit, all these things that just set you up for failure. So you can't get apartments and you can't get jobs because you have felonies or whatever. So there's a lot of work to decrim the girl who seemingly was consensual, but was under pimp control. And so she's the victim in this case. Therefore, she shouldn't bear these felonies on her record. So there's movements and work to get that removed. And part two of it is the financial black marks, right? So just getting rid of these bad credit things so they can get apartments. So these agencies are working with them to get those things set up, but also walk with them to get better housing, better jobs, stable, and get just stabilized in the world. And it's very hard. It's quick money. And Harmony Grillo, she's out west and she has a place called LA Treasures. And she would say years out after being out of it, when money gets tight, her first thought is, I could make $500 in one night. And she has,
which is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. It's very fast. And so your brain, even we suppress the bad, we remember the good. And that's why a lot of these girls stay in the relationships too, because it was good. Those first 6 months were amazing. He saw me, took care of me, he spoiled me. We can get back to that.
Yeah. The brain is a very tricky thing. It creates those grooves, and those grooves are very hard to change, those neurological grooves. This may be insensitive, right? But I think as I'm listening and I'm hearing this, my suburban white male libertarian brain goes, yeah, but there's a lot of personal responsibility here, right? Yeah. You chose to start an OnlyFans. You chose to go work as a stripper. You chose to date this person. These are your choices and it led to these bad consequences. So why are you a victim?
Yeah.
How would you answer that person?
Yeah, that's great because we created a film around choice and we have zero dialogue and a bunch of bad things, just nuanced bad things, battery dying, things like that on her phone. Because in these homes, they are saying that. They're saying this was, if I had just never gone to that party, if I would just never accepted that DM, if I just never would have did this or that, I wouldn't be here. And you can see how they get that, right? The dominoes lined up. But when it comes to choice, you did make a choice to show up at that place, or you made that choice to meet that guy, but you did not choose what he did to you. You did not choose, you trusted him. And he is the one that exploited that trust. He is the one that consciously, intentionally took advantage of that vulnerability. And that's why you are the victim. And it's interesting though, some survivors don't like the word, even word survivor or victim. They're like, no, I'm an overcomer. Mm-hmm. And they absolutely are. But in the true sense of the word, you are a victim because you were preyed upon. So that's not on you. You should be able to move through this world without fear and know that you're protected and that know that you're safe and know that you have value. And somebody came along and they mentally took you. So in the same way, back to the African experience where they get grabbed and thrown into that white van, right? Is that their fault they were in the white van? No, in the same way. And that's what we're trying to help them ungrip, just like that classic scene from Good Will Hunting. It's not your fault. It's not your fault.
What do you make of QAnon and the Epstein stuff and the internet and some of which, in some ways, I could see how it's good that this concept of, look, we need to be conscious of predators and there may be more when.
Yes.
But like when you see some of that as someone who has experience and understanding of all this, what do you make of the internet conversation around trafficking and child abuse and all this?
Yeah, I think it's misinformation. It really shows up in the ERs too. These girls are harmed. They're beat. When men purchase sex, there is this belief that I have carte blanche. I completed my part of the transaction. I gave you money. And so they feel this free will to do things. And so there are initiatives to reduce demand, buyer demand. And actually, if you get rid of the buyer, this thing goes away overnight. So those doing the work, that's amazing work.
What does that look like?
It's letting guys know, okay, when you purchase sex, here's what's happening after you leave. And here's what you're doing. And just because you pass money, it's still another human being. And so just, again, the porn and the things like that have also created these images that say that this is okay.
It's a cultural understanding of the Imago Dei, that everyone's created in the image of God, that everyone's worthy of dignity and respect and liberty, and you are participating in a system that is robbing someone of that.
Absolutely.
Even though it is not caught, you may view it differently, the royal you.
But yes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
That totally is it. And so,
like in the abortion space, 60% of abortions are from young Christian women because they don't feel their family will support them.
Right.
And they will be shamed.
Yes.
And so no one will know. And then they go and they have an abortion and then they live with that regret and that shame. And my wife's working with Embrace Grace as a way to say, look, you'll be celebrated by somebody.
Yeah.
Right. You don't have to go through with this thing that you don't want to do, but to feel you have no other choice.
Right.
That's a very cultural thing that, you know, if with men, if we, the royal we, can get men to start thinking differently about things, that'll take the demand away.
100%.
Yeah,
love that. Yeah, that's huge. But yeah, as far as then moving through out, like it goes back to the protective factors and like you're talking about engaging with your kids, obviously being present, knowing who they are, who they're with. Every kid game seems to have a chat feature.
Yeah.
So from Roblox to Minecraft to what have you. And those are all doorways to getting access to your kid. And so just figuring out what does that look like in your home, like checking those messages or how to still get trust with your kiddo, but also realize, hey, this isn't the same. A gal from the FBI did a talk on internet safety, and she said, your kid going and taking a shower, that's privacy. Give your kid that space. But your kid being on Snapchat or whatever, that's a different type of privacy. And as a parent, you should be very engaged with that.
So I have not seen the Tim Ballard movie, Sound of Freedom.
Okay.
It started a lot of conversations about some of this stuff.
It did.
What would you say to me? I'm going to go watch the movie. Where would you go, look, here's the good, here's the bad? What did you think of it?
So the good is it does happen in Cambodia. His story is true. Tim Ballard and his organization, which he's since left, called OUR. Those are true events that happen. And it is the van gathering the kids and trafficking them somewhere else. But it's also Cambodia. And I feel like at the end, Jim Caviezel gets on there and tries to bring it back to the U.S. And I feel like that was not helpful, because that's not what's happening here. So that just reinforced the misinformation. And that's big. I meant to mention this earlier, but like our ERs, because they get harmed, they're showing up in our ERs 6, 8, 9 times on average, they're saying. Our doctors and our ER staff got to get really good at being able to identify this, because you can't ask them, are you being trafficked? Because the answer will be no.
Yeah.
Because 70, 80% of them don't know. They're just in a bad DV situation.
Yeah.
So we have to get better with our questions. So Sound of Freedom. So that's good. Like it did that, but it was still misrepresentative of what actually takes place in the United States. And then in my opinion, the last part is they don't show the recovery, which is the space we care about. They just show the kid coming back and they present the kid like he's unscathed. I'm like, you know how much trauma that child has just experienced?
Right, yeah.
She's not okay. And she's going to need lots of therapy and lots of help and lots of just services just to help her undo that damage.
So let's start that conversation about recovery in the space that you're working in. I hear you say they don't know, but if you're having sex that often and there's money being exchanged, like how does someone not know? And then how do you and the organizations you work with unnormalize that behavior?
Yeah. So one story of a gal was, she was in a restroom at an airport in the stall, and there's, are you being trafficked? 1-800 hotline, the hotline, which is a good hotline, by the way. And we do need to distribute that number, which I don't have off the top of my head, so we'll put that in the show notes.
Okay.
But she was like, no, that's not me, because I'm about to hop on a plane, a private plane, eat caviar. That's not me. I'm living the high life. So
for her, it's almost, it's a business. It's a business. Transactional. I'm making the choice, right?
Seemingly.
She's not necessarily seeing the power structure that she's working in.
She does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's getting really creative with the questions. Are you being required to sell sex for goods? Or do you have the freedom to make your own financial decisions? It's getting really good and the intakes are continuing to get better. There's tons of people working on this stuff. Heal Trafficking is an amazing organization that's working with those doctors and trying to get that better to identify for them. But yes, educating the young people and identifying that these things are not okay. It's not okay for somebody to expect you to do this or that. Like, regardless of what they've done for you, even if they've given you gifts, you saw boundary work, right? Mm-hmm. You still have the right to say no. Because somebody gave you a gift doesn't mean that you owe them something in return. Classic dating, like growing up, you would always hear about these sleazeballs that would take a nice girl out to dinner and then say, let's go back to my place. And they would expect sex. And you would hear the cliche of, I bought your dinner. Mm. And like somewhere in our culture, we created this transactional thing that if I give you something, you somehow are therefore owed me something back. And so just helping young people realize, regardless of what has been given to you, you don't owe anybody anything. And yeah, and then it's easy for us to sit on this side of it and say, oh my gosh, the money is being like...
Isn't it obvious?
Isn't it obvious? Yeah, but right. It's been so normalized. And it typically starts out like, oh, we need the car fixed. My buddy will do it if you'll sleep with him for $400. But just this one time, babe, do it for us. And eventually one day we're going to move to Hawaii or we're going to move out west, but we just got to do it for now. So they just normalize it and say, I know it's not the best, but if we could just do it for now, because I love you and we're going to have a life together. But we're in a jam right now. So if you could just do it this one time. And then they move the needle, and then they move the needle. Mm. And then you find yourself in those situations. You're like, and survivors, the number one question they get is, why didn't you just leave?
Yeah.
And that's, so never ask us, dear listeners, never ask a survivor, why didn't you just leave?
I know that seems obvious, but
it does.
Anybody who's lived past, I don't know, there's a lot of obtuse 60-year-olds, but like having been 40 and gone through things, you go at the time, like I just didn't think of it, didn't know any, it's not that I didn't know any better, I guess that's not the way to say it, that's just where I was in life, and then other people come along and show you a better way,
yeah.
Or they make you think about things, like the pornography example of, I never had anybody challenge it, I never thought about it that way, let me think about that, and then in the opposite direction, the needle moves further.
Yeah.
Where you start to go, okay, I was pro-choice and now I'm very pro-life, especially after what we went through. It's, every person listening can relate to being in one mindset and then maybe 10 years later being in a different mindset.
Oh my gosh,
and that's
yes.
A gradual process of changing your mind and your frame of reference.
And frame of reference is so huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that statement of like, why didn't you just leave? And a lot of these agencies we work with, the girl will call that number. There's this story where a lady gives them a business card and says, if you ever need help, call us or something. And they memorize the number, this, that, and the other. And so they finally call the number and they go to, is it Made? Is the TV show, Netflix show Made?
Yeah.
Made. Might tap into this a little bit. I think one of her peers just disappears or whatever.
Like, yeah.
So they'll call and they'll even call and that person will come and pick them up. It is Made.
She's at that. So it's a great show, and
it's probably more accurate than Sound of Freedom.
Don't watch it. Yeah, don't watch it with your wife if she's been through stuff because it's triggering.
Yeah, no, it's authentic.
Because it's very authentic. Yeah,
and
she's at a home, and then her best friend goes back. They have all these conversations about how horrible he was and how awful, and how they're getting it together, and then she's just gone one day because she went back with him.
And this film has been brought up. This was validating to our work too. So the clinician I work with, she had a client actually say, have you seen Maid? And she wasn't able to articulate her own story, her own. She didn't have the words for it, but she was able to reference Maid and say what I'm feeling. That's what happened to me. And yeah, so even as they make that phone number, just, and they get there and they now have this housing and they have this job, go back. And the phrase I've heard so many times is, as hard as it is to get out of the life, it's harder to stay out. It's like the sirens of the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Just calling them back. Because our brains are saying, like, oh, but the money was good. And at least I knew. Our brains are also like, that which is known is comfortable, right? What we know says so much. And how many guys have been in the same job 50 plus years? Maybe not so much anymore, but they would never leave because they just knew that job, but they hated it.
Yeah.
Why don't you go get a new job? I know this job. And that's a very light version of this, but it's just a deeper version of that. Like, why didn't you leave? Where would I go? I had zero money. Who can I trust? He'll find me. And I would be worse off. And when they return, they are rarely rewarded. So it just reinforces that. If you leave again, it'll be worse. So why? So now there's, but sometimes they do leave. And what does help is those few moments they are in care, words can be planted into them, seeds can be, and hopefully with our films, visuals can even stick with them so that they do run back. Now they have something to at least contrast to their experience. Oh, you believe he loves you? Yeah, but if he loves you, why is he doing this or this? And then when those things begin to happen, now the doubt has been there. Maybe they were right.
So how are your films shown? How do you get access to men or women who are in these situations? How do they come across what you do at Point of View Stories?
Yeah, so there are conferences across the nation. Well, in fact, we'll be in Utah next month in about 2 weeks at the Sheltered Alliance. Shared Hope puts on a big one called Juvenile Sex Trafficking Conference every fall between DC and another city. And a lot of these agencies, folks doing this work, come to these conferences. And so we typically have a booth and we introduce ourselves and share what we're doing. Also, we're in common email groups, passing information, or online through LinkedIn. I'm also volunteering for Violence Against Men and Boys, which will be taking place in Miami this June. So getting in contact with those people and sharing our work through those channels. And we have a streaming platform that our films sit on. And so our members that actually implement the films, that's how they gain physical access to the films. And then they just weave it into their treatment plans, their therapies, their groups that they do.
What's the most common? Is it homes? Is it, can I relate it to domestic violence? Here we have the Julian Center, which is a shelter, and women can go to some place like that to help transition them if they're in a violent situation, especially. Are there homes? Are you adding on services? Is the, again, sorry to use the word traffic, but the anti-trafficking movement, are they adding on services to those homes, or are there specific resources that are very common that we just don't hear about as much for women who are involved in these
situations? Yeah, I volunteered at the Connor House with their outdoor mulching for several years.
And which is?
It's just a physical home in Carmel. It's a two-story home, and it's DV wives and moms. They have little ones, but they're in a domestic. They're not being trafficked, but they're in a domestic violence situation. So they're in this undisclosed home in Carmel that where they're living to get that safety and get being safe. So it's very much that model. It's the staffing and the servicing that comes with it, because while both are in harmful situations, the one that's gone through a commercial sexual exploitation, their experience and their trauma work is going to be different than somebody in a DV. It's similar, but it's also more complex. So complex trauma, the CPTSD, is more prevalent in the trafficking lived experience versus the domestic violence potentially. So there are different, just being more the kind of trauma informed and things of that nature. So there are curriculums and materials and resources specific to somebody coming through the trafficking experience versus the DV. So they, at least today, they tend to be different agencies with different funding models and different trained staff and different resources.
Yeah, I've noticed in my research for this, tons of different resources and people doing a bunch of different things.
Yes.
Like, there's a lot of organizations that are working on this stuff, right?
Yeah, there really is. And it's more siloed than it probably needs to be. And hopefully with time, people, that's a big question we get. Do you plan to expand? Because it seems like sexual assault is the next thing over and very similar. Mm. And then DV outside of that. And then prevention and awareness outside of that. And yeah, so we definitely want to try to bring more of these silos and be more of a horizontal resource.
Why do you think this isn't talked about, or as I feel like domestic violence and sexual violence are, I feel like it's talked about more?
Yeah.
Is it just, is this just less prevalent, and that is it that people don't want to give up their behaviors that contribute to these systems, and so they don't want to confront it? Or like, why is it not on the same plane as those two issues that are very related?
And historically, there's behind the ball, DV's been around, what, 40 plus years, so we've had time to get those services
the open. Services around domestic violence, we should
domestic
violence goes way back. Right, yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
No, you're right. The services. And so I don't
Which is mind-blowing that it's only the 80s that we really start taking that seriously.
Yeah.
That's wild.
So I think we're just behind in that regard. And so another very stark evidence of that is, I mentioned complex trauma, or CPTSD for short. It's, to this day, at this moment, is not in the DSM.
Hmm.
So those who don't know what the DSM is, it's the Bible for mental health.
Yeah.
It's everything the U.S. works off of. The WHO just added it.
Mm.
And so why that's problematic is we can't treat something that doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
And so when you go to get things codified and things of that nature, it's not. Now,
and that
shades
matters,
of it are
that,
there.
That matters for insurance purposes?
Exactly. Right, for insurance purposes, treatments, to be able for the therapies and
funding,
the modalities.
From foundations and tax write-offs. And
so
you
look at you mentioned therapy earlier. So typically when you go see a therapist, they have a modality that they're tapping into.
Mm.
Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT for short, that's one. Internal family systems, IFS, that's one. Emotional focus therapy, that's one. And there's many more. But all those were born out of looking at the specific context. Now we're talking about the commercial sexual exploitation experience. None of these modalities had that in mind. So they just don't fit well. So now there's one on the horizon called NARM, N-A-R-M for short. And so it really is just, we're four laps behind the leader.
Yeah.
And getting into the DSM is going to be big. Getting just the services and the modalities and the talk-based therapies up to speed. And we call ourselves, we're using film as an intervention tool. So it's not a modality, but it can support a modality. And it is bringing that individual experience to the conversation. And trauma-informed, another phrase of that is being tailor-made for that survivor, because their experience, while they may experience the similar events, the way their body holds trauma is very different. And in fact, the way trauma is explained, it's not what happened to you. It's how your body holds it in response
to
it.
What does the mean, body holding trauma? What does that mean?
Yeah, so a very groundbreaking book called The Body Keeps the Score has been heralded as like a groundbreaking understanding of trauma. In a smaller sense, something that happened to me was I was at Near East Side at an Olive Garden and my car got broken into while I was inside the restaurant. So I come outside and I find my computer gone and my rear driver's side window smashed. Super violating, pretty low T, small T trauma for sure. I wasn't physically harmed, but it was something that just messed with me for a while. Let's say you went through that same experience. You might hold that differently. You might be all like, yeah, East Side.
Right, yeah. Believe me. I got all four of my tires stolen. I just made a joke out of it because what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Like, you can hold that differently. Like, it was how you responded to it. And being trauma-informed is understanding that and working with that person. And healing is never linear. And so...
So it doesn't mean that I have a trauma happen to me, so then all of a sudden my back seizes up. It's not like physically you're holding it and it's...
There's like some elements of that for sure.
All right.
But yeah, but the idea of the body keeps the score, the body remembers, and it can hold things.
Whereas your response may be anger and stewing on it. Mine is I'll put it on the internet as a joke. Two different responses.
Two different responses. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But we have evidence like stress brings health problems, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so if you are stressing, if you're always in a state of high fight, flight, or freeze, or fawn modes, like we know the chemicals, the serotonins, the dopamines, whatever, are constantly flooding, puts you in does things. It literally physically rewires your brain. And took a NAMI course, N-A-M-I, National, I'll have to Google that one too. But National Addiction of, I'll let it go. But anyways, they do great work on looking at brain scans of what our brains look like in trauma. And it really is differently. And a lot of these girls have been put in these heightened, imagine your car stuck in fifth gear. That's what these girls are.
And you get addicted to drama when you live in drama. When you, when you totally live in chaos, you get addicted to chaos.
Chaos is formal. Back to what I know is what I'm comfortable, because it's known at least. And so when you're trying to bring those bodies back to a normal state, yeah, there's just a lot of rewiring and physicality that has to happen to get you back to there. So you don't, and they call it the window of tolerance or resilience. And somebody's gone through that level of trauma, their window of tolerance is really low. So it could be something as just a phrase. There's one pimp that would, several pimps that might use the be sweet. They would always tell the girls, hey, remember, be sweet. So someone jokingly tells them a joke at a neighborhood barbecue, says, yeah, you're sweet. Boom, triggered because of that window of tolerance. So part of that work is just building that window of tolerance so that when they get told, hey, you're sweet, it doesn't become such an activating experience. Mm. And that's where the work takes place. And it's going to be a little bit different for her than it is for the DV victim.
Okay, got it. How can people support your work? Where do they find it?
Yeah.
Shameless self-promotion time.
I appreciate that. Now, pointofviewstory.com. We're, at the end of the day, we're trying to get our films into these agencies. And while we have a fiscal agent, you can definitely donate to us. We're looking for partners for agencies that maybe don't have a lot of dollars. And so reach out to me. We'll connect you with an agency and you can walk hand in hand with them in the front lines.
So around the country, if I'm in Texas and I'm listening to this and I feel moved to do something, what kind of local agency should I send an email to and say, hey, check these people out?
Oh my gosh, yeah. Hop on Polaris is a wonderful website. Google like national trafficking websites. They have maps of all the agencies that are doing, well, hopefully all the agencies, but many of the agencies that are doing this work. The OJC, the Office of Justice and Criminal, that's what it stands for. There are a lot of the federal dollars. See where their dollars are going. And also the VOCA grant, the Violence Against Children, is also a lot of the dollars that are fueling and supporting this work. Follow those dollars where they're going. Those agencies are potential partners for us. But yes, pointofviewstory.com on the web, Instagram, LinkedIn. We do have monthly film reviews where we show a film, we break it down beat by beat and show how somebody can engage with it. So anybody's welcome to hop on those calls. We'll post that on LinkedIn. So once a month, folks can just zoom.
So like Forrest Gump, like that kind of movie?
Or no, one of your movies. Okay, one of our movies. Yeah, 5 minutes.
Right.
Five minutes.
I didn't even mean to be funny. Okay. Because I thought in my brain, you're like breaking down a movie going, this is the problem with this thing. But okay.
Right. No. Just helping them like you're talking about choices earlier. How do we navigate what we can own and what we don't have to own? And so we have a film for that.
Great.
Got an app for that. Got a film for that. So yeah, pointofviewstory.com, Mark at pointofviewstory.com, here in Fountain Square. We'd love to meet folks and just help us get this amazing tool into the hands of those helping them find freedom.
All right. Mark Steenbarger.
Yes, sir.
Got it. Okay. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Chris, thank you. I appreciate you caring about the subject and just sharing it with
absolutely
your audience.
Absolutely. It was tremendous learning experience for me and I think for everybody else. Thanks so much for listening here on the Chris Spangle Show. If you got something out of it, the best thing you can do is share this knowledge with other people. We appreciate that.
Absolutely.
And we appreciate Mark's time and we appreciate your time. Thanks so much for listening here on the Chris Spangle Show. Here at The Chris Spangle Show, we are dedicated to helping you understand current events in a new and hopeful way. And it takes a lot of resources for our team to make that happen. So please consider supporting our work now via Patreon at supportcss.com so that we can continue to be a sane voice in a media landscape that no longer incentivizes it. Thanks especially to our $100 a month members, Vincent Peichel, Matthew Durbin, and Reinhold. Thanks to all of our patrons for making this show a reality.